Welcome to the Grow Zone, real-time adventures. With Sarah Hubner, the communications adventurer, and Kerry Temple, the outdoor adventurer. Hello, and welcome to our fourth episode of our second series of the Grow Zone real-time adventures. My name is Sarah Hubner, and I am the communications adventurer in the Grow Zone. And my adventures take place in the realm of communication and theatre. I'm a communications facilitator for team building, resilience, and storytelling, and I also design interactive online events. By my side is Kerry Temple, the outdoors adventurer. Kerry, where do your adventures take place?
My adventures, funnily enough, take place in the great outdoors. I design experiences and adventures combining exploring nature, local cultures, and creating different experiences and events for promoting physical health and well-being, as well as personal development.
Fabulous. So we're into our second series where we interview other adventurers from various fields. And our very special guest today is John Gartese. Kerry, could you say a couple of words about John, please?
Yep, of course. So when we talked about our series for interviewing real-time adventurers, straight away I knew that we'd have to invite John Gartese to talk with us. John is an Alaskan Californian based now in Munich, and we've been met through working together at Munich International School, where I coordinate the Duke of Edinburgh's award programme. John works also teaching supply and also leapt on board the Duke of Edinburgh's award programme and has been supporting with the MIS expedition since 2015. Now, John's career is interwoven with adventure. During university, where he read philosophy and psychology, his passions were for sports and trying to make a professional football team. When this didn't work out, he took to travel, hitchhiking first through Mexico and Central America. This led to further journeys and adventure through Europe, New Zealand, Australia, Asia, Africa, pretty much across the world, ultimately landing in Kodiak Island, Alaska. And has proved a worthy playground for the next chapter as he worked there in public schools over the course of 20 years. And over the course of the 20 years there, he completed some of the most renowned adventures on the planet, climbing Mount McKinley, hiking the Chilkoot Trail, I hope I pronounced that correctly, floating 1,200 kilometres from the source of the Yukon to Dawson City and mushing with dogs 2,000 kilometres in the Iditarod's dog sled race. Now, these are serious adventures. And in actual fact, the travel as an adventure list is so long that I think we could use the whole podcast just listing them all. John's now retired from teaching and living in Munich and has also started writing up some of his tales of adventures about sailing solo around the world, following Hannibal's trail on bicycle through the Alps. And he's a real advocate for the outdoors, spending time in nature and seeks to share this with younger generations, supporting programs such as the Duke of Edinburgh's Awards, as well as creating children's stories about flowers to encourage kids to learn and connect with the nature around them. He's a real inspiration, not just for me, but also the younger generations that we work with. So I'm delighted that John said yes to joining us on our podcast, Real Time Adventure, and talking with him today on a different setting discover some of the roots of his love of adventure and also find out what skills he believes you can build for real-time adventures. So, John, is there anything I've missed or would you like to add anything that I've just said about you?
No, yes. Thank you for having me with you. And no, you summed it up wonderfully well. Yeah, thank you very much.
Super.
So, John, I'm going to ask you some quick fire questions, and there's no right or wrong. Just answer whatever comes to your mind first.
All right.
So, good. Outdoors or indoors?
Outdoors.
Adventure or comfort zone?
Adventure.
Mountain or stage?
Definitely mountain.
Cake or chips?
Ooh, That's a tough one. I would say cake, but I don't eat either of them too much.
Oh, that's very healthy. Early bird or night owl?
Early bird. Yes.
And again, one or two words. What do you think of when you hear adventure?
Ooh, I think of a new experience.
What do you think of when you hear improvisation?
Resourcefulness and spontaneity.
And what do you think of when you hear learning?
Change of behavior.
Mm-hmm. Three words that describe you.
Friendly and a risk taker, and I would say somebody that enjoys activities, a athletic person.
Yeah, I can definitely say that friendly is true. The other two are very obvious, but friendly, in my own experience, as we briefly mentioned when we spoke before the recording, you were the first person to talk to me when I was at MIS and as a new teacher and sort of just looking around the school, and I bumped into you and you right away introduced yourself and sort of gave me a nice little introduction to the school, and I felt at ease. So that definitely is due to your friendliness and was lovely.
Oh, thank you very much. Yes, I like to make people feel comfortable in a new setting, and because everybody has something to offer, and being comfortable is important to open up to that environment.
Mm. Yeah, it's difficult to be a risk taker if you're not feeling comfortable with the people around you.
Yes, I think so too. And it's just, well, thanks for remembering that. And I'm happy I made a little impression there.
Definitely. And you mentioned that cake or chips, you don't eat either very often. Do you lead a very healthy lifestyle?
Yes, I try to. I'm interested in so many things that years ago I read a book called Sugar Blues. It's just like 30 years ago, and it exaggerated somewhat, but it used some scientific studies, but it just talked about the effect that sugar has on people's bodies, and it was not good. And it was refined sugar, but it wasn't so good. So although growing up, I always ate chocolate cake for my birthday, I'm sure, because I like that. But I just, I'm not a big fan of chips or that kind of food and cakes. And it's tough in Germany, because in Germany, the Germans seem to have Kuchen cake in the afternoons on Saturdays or Sundays, or they hike up to Hutas to have cake. And so, yeah, it's a little difficult, but I try not to eat too much of it.
Yeah. And it seems, may we know your age?
Oh, yes. I'm 73 now.
73, yes. And you're still very active and still climb mountains. So that maybe not reducing your sugar intake as part of that.
Yeah, I hope so. I don't know whether it's genetic or it's just environmental, but yeah, I think of expressions like but I can't think of them very well, but use it or lose it. So if you don't use your muscles, if you don't use your brain, if you don't use whatever, you're going to lose it at some point in time. So
do you have any like regimes, fitness regimes or routines that you do to help you?
Yes, actually I belong to a sports gym, and I try to work out every night, and I go there late at night when I'm all alone. Then I could just focus. It's kind of meditational, touching weights. And so I work out until it closes at 11. And then I come home and I probably don't go to sleep until 12. But so every day I try to do something. And if it's raining and I just don't want to take my bike to the to the gym, I might do push-ups or crunches. And then on nice days like yesterday, I go for long runs and go for long bike rides. And so I try to every day I try to stay active.
So John, one of the things I know that about you is that you are obviously very physically active, and obviously that's come throughout your life. But what inspired really your love of sport? Were you always sporty as a child as well?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. This is a memorable story for me. When I was in seventh grade, I believe, the popular kids were in a glee club. And so, so I liked those kids. And so I wanted to be part of that group. And so I went and I tried out for a glee club. The teacher, after I tried out, said, John, why don't you just stay out for sports? Play sports. And so I realized that I couldn't sing then. And so, but it was a nice way of her telling me that, you know, I should just do something that I'm pretty good at. So I'm coordinated. And so I was playing on the basketball and the baseball and the football teams. And I just loved to run and jump and throw and catch. And so so that's just carried me through my life. So I enjoy sports. And then when I could not participate on teams, then I did activities individually or alone. And so that's when I would take up mountain climbing and those kind of sports.
Yeah, and that's how you kind of got into travel and adventure. Was it the travel that came first or the adventure, the kind of adventure that...
Yes, no, I think travel inspired me to be that adventurous, because I just lived a pretty sheltered life. I grew up in Elko, Nevada. Mm-hmm. I lived there until I was 12. And so I was pretty isolated in the outdoors. And my dad took me hunting, and I don't know if I killed anything. I mean, I wouldn't kill anything now. And I fished with him, and I don't fish now, but I was familiar with the outdoors. But it wasn't until after college when I traveled on my own, and then I saw a whole new world. And when I was in 12 or 13, my parents took us to the World's Fair in Seattle, and that was a different experience. And we went down to Los Angeles to see my uncle, and to see an orange grow on a tree was just was memorable, because I didn't know where oranges came from. But now as I get older, you know, I realize there's probably a lot of city children that don't know where oranges come from. And so I thought, I wish everybody could just see the natural world and grow and develop and appreciate it. Mm-hmm. And live life that way.
That's interesting, and how that still have that memory from when you're that old, that it still sticks with you to relate to that today, to encourage other children also to make those connections.
I think we're all formed by earlier experiences. Yeah, fortunately, I had good experiences, and I'm sure the bad ones, maybe I don't remember quite as much, but traveling was just just opened my eyes, and I thought, oh, there's more to the world than just me or my family or my little town. And somehow, somewhere along the line, I felt that we're all connected somehow, and all the people and all the life forms are somehow connected. So it was I don't know what came first, traveling or adventure, but they merged together.
In your first travel adventures, what were the biggest challenges, and maybe how do they compare to travel and adventures now? Are they similar challenges or different?
Yes, that's a thoughtful question. You know, the biggest challenges for me when I was I was on a Little League baseball all-star team, and we went to some place to play baseball, and we were housed in other people's, in other families' houses at our host city. Mm-hmm. I remember I was housed in a Mexican family. It was so different. It was so challenging. I had difficulty handling it because I smelled tacos in the morning and burritos, and they were speaking Spanish. It was just, you know, they were a darker skin color. There were just so many differences. I was just shocked. And so I don't know whether I went to my coach or a good friend of mine. And so I moved out of the house to somebody else's house for my culture, I suppose, or maybe in with another baseball player. And, you know, reflecting on it, I feel badly about that family because they were so generous and nice, but it was such a challenge. And so it made me think about what was my problem. So now when I, you know, when I traveled later on in my 20s, like I was in South Africa and I was with my tent just outside the airport, Black people would walk by me and all I saw was Black people. This is during apartheid. And they walked by me and they said, "Oh, hello, Buana. Hello, Buana." And I'm saying, I'm 22 or something, 23. And I said to them, "Oh, you don't have to call me Buana." And they said, "No, Buana, Buana." And so that was shocking to me and a challenge. But I thought, why is it like this? What's it all about? And then I thought about how, for me, apartheid was so unfair and how these people were conditioned and they just respected me. And I was just a hitchhiking person with a tent. Yeah. So every time I go on adventure, I'm challenged and I just, I want to better myself on every adventure, whether finding my way or helping somebody overcome some obstacle. But yeah, so I just, I still have challenges and hopefully I get through them in a better way than I did when I was younger.
I have a possibly difficult question for you to answer. Out of all the adventures you've had, which one would you say was the greatest?
Oh, Sarah, that's a difficult question.
I thought so.
Yeah. You know, I don't think any adventure was the greatest, but when I did the Iditarod, Carrie, that's the way we pronounced it up there.
That's the last time. Apologies, my friend.
Yeah, Iditarod. It was just it was very difficult adventure because
can you explain what that is?
Iditarod. Yes. In Alaska, there are major cities, Anchorage. But in the early 1900s, Fairbanks, a gold mining city, was a major city too. And on the coast, on the Bering Sea, there's a little village called Nome. And they had an outbreak of diphtheria. And so they needed a serum to save the people. And they couldn't, there's no way to get serum there in the middle of the winter because the ice was frozen over, so boats couldn't get in. Airplanes were, in the very early stages, no roads. And so they decided to take the serum with dog teams. So they had a dog team relay. So they would just take this serum, and somehow they must have had radio communication that they needed this. And so they took this serum from, I think from Fairbanks instead of Anchorage, but all the way to Nome, which was, well, from Anchorage, they say it's 1,000 miles, which is like 1,800 kilometers probably. And they would go on relays. And so dog teams and mushers would take this serum across the tundra, over the mountains, across frozen rivers. And then they would hand it off to the next musher waiting for them at the next village. And it's such a part of Alaskan history that there was a famous dog by name of Balto, B-A-L-T-O, that was a lead dog. And these lead dogs are just tremendous animals. They can sense where a trail is. They follow commands. They don't take you over cliffs. They do all these remarkable feats. And so Leonard Seppala, a famous musher, went to a village and the man wasn't ready. And Leonard says, "Huh, forget this. I'm just going to keep going." And he kept going. And I think his dog, lead dog, was Balto. But anyway, they got this serum to Nome and it saved people. Well, in about 1973, they decided to start a race like this from Anchorage. And Anchorage is about 1,000 miles from Nome. And it's the Alaska came into the United States as a 49th state and 1959. And so they said, "Oh, we have 1,049 miles between Anchorage and Nome." So we mushers, I was in, they have this as an annual race. And I was probably in the seventh or eighth race. And it started in, like, I think 1973, and I did in 1980. And so you just start in Nome, and then it's the first, you have checkpoints along the way because it's 30 below zero and it's blizzarding, and there's fissures in the ice on the Bering Sea, and yeah, you could die out there. But so they have checkpoints every well, I'm talking miles, but I live in Germany where we use kilometers, but every 50 miles or 70 miles. So you check in and there's a check so you don't get lost. And so you check in and then you get extra food because you can't carry everything. And it took me 21 days and nights to mush my dogs to Nome. I knew I could do this. And I trained a bit for 3 months before. And I was the only musher that had my dogs in Anchorage out on a field. And I'd go there at night after I would teach school and then train during the night. And so, yeah, so I continued to Nome, and then my dogs quit after they wouldn't go any farther after about 900 miles. And I was so discouraged and I was so angry. And yes, I remember one story quickly. This dog, a swing dog, it's the second dog behind the leader, would just was not pulling, which, and I could tell because even in the dark with my headlight on, I could see the slack line around its collar, and all the other dogs are pulling. And so I went up, the dog's name was Brandy. And I said, "Brandy, you got to pull, you got to do this. I mean, you're just a team player." And like I'm talking to a human. But Brandy was just not pulling. And so I asked a native Alaskan, I said, "You know, and these people have so much experience mushing dogs." I said, "What do I do?" And he said, "Oh, bite Brandy's ear." And I said, "No, I can't bite Brandy's ear." And he said, "Bite her ear and she will pull for you." So next time it happened, I went up and I knelt down next to Brandy and I talked to Brandy. And then I reached over and I bit Brandy's ear. And I felt blood coming in my mouth. And I think I bit it too hard. But Brandy just yelped and just took off running. And I had to jump back. I think I had my snow hook in, but it came out. And the dog team just took off. And then I jumped on the sled as it went by. And so that was fine for about 2 days. And then Brandy stopped pulling again. And I went up, I stopped, and I said, "Brandy," and I bit Brandy's ear, and Brandy took off. And then, so that worked. And then one time Brandy just, and across the Bering Sea, there was nothing out there, it's flat. It's as flat as any flat land you've ever seen. And it's just all white. And Brandy just, and for days like that, and it's foggy and it was snowing, but Brandy just took off in another direction. So I went and I stopped in the middle of the night and I went up to Brandy and I grabbed Brandy's cuff of her by her throat. And I was just so intent on finishing and finishing this. And I didn't know what to do, but I wasn't going to bite Brandy. And then I stopped and I looked around at all the other dogs that were sitting there looking at me. And it was as if these dogs in unison said to me, you know, why are you bothering Brandy? Because Brandy is finished. She can't pull anymore. She's had it. And I felt so badly. I mean, I just, it was just like a telepathic, loud communication to me. And so I backed off and I undid Brandy's collar and the harness that she was on. I picked up Brandy and I put Brandy in my basket and put her in there and petted her. And we all continued. And the next checkpoint, I left Brandy and the checkpoint to be flown back to the finish line in Nome. And then we continued. But yeah, I finished third from last, I think. But there were still people cheering me on at 4 a.m. coming in. Mm-hmm. And the first place musher finished 1 week before I came in. But yeah, I was happy to finish. And that was yeah, a great challenge and one of my great adventures. So
it wasn't about winning.
No, it wasn't about winning. It was about finishing. And it was about experiencing. But, you know, as I think back mm-hmm. on it, the challenge is doing it. It's the events that occur as a challenge happens. And the product is important, but to me, it's just participating in the adventure, I think, that's the most gratifying.
Mm. And it seems the most memorable moments are often the ones where challenges happened.
Yes, certainly. But when I was teaching 2 days ago, a student said something about an assessment or test or a challenge. But I told them that from my experience that challenges happen every day and you're challenged every day. And whether it's in a conversation or whether it's being honest in an answer or whether it's whatever it is, it's just, there are challenges in life. And I think, it's just, they are the most memorable, I'm sure.
I think like from listening to that story and listening to other stories, I think what you realize also the incredible personal growth that comes from those events and from those, from taking part in all the in challenges and adventures. Yeah, you're learning so much about not just about yourself, but dealing with other people and dealing with, down to dealing with the dogs and realizing that you're not just the person by yourself there, but you rely on all different aspects,
yes.
I guess. And that's a big part of adventures, is getting to know all the different aspects that are part of it.
Yes, exactly. Just we're all connected some way, and they're wonderful memories. And I think, as you grow older, as you grow, mm-hmm. I think, you should develop and just make the most of the situation. And yeah, adventures do that for me. They make me, I think, a better person, and they fulfill my need to improve and to be the best I can be.
What pieces of advice would you give to people who are maybe a bit more fearful of stepping into adventures?
I would say that everybody has a phobia. I mean, I think of the book 1984 and that protagonist is fear. But I think, whether it's COVID and you're afraid of needles, or whether it's a large group of people or whatever it is, I would say that I think to maximize your growth, you have to take risk. And so, you have to overcome them somehow. And so I would suggest that you just, if you really want to experience whatever you want to experience, you just have to take a deep breath and find a way to break through that barrier to experience what you want to experience. Because if you don't try, then nothing is gained and you're missing out on a big part of life. So I would just say, you have to do whatever it takes to get over it, whether it's do it with a friend or just close your eyes and just believe in yourself and believe in your abilities and just move forward to accomplishing that. So those are my thoughts. So I really enjoy experiences. And now at my age, I'm limited with what I can do a bit because, when I was down in Aconcagua two years ago, I mean, I couldn't carry 70 kilos on my back. And I don't know if I ever could, but it was hard to, it was just so hard to, well, physically impossible for me to carry all that. So I would double carry my load, but I'm picking experiences that I think I can do. I mean, I wanted to run around the Starnberger Sea, and I did that this summer just to do that. And to just kind of run all night and it was just a modest adventure, and it's probably 50 kilometers or 52 kilometers, but it was just so gratifying because I knew I could do it, but just to see the little hedgehogs and the foxes at night and hear the cuckoo birds and see the sunrise and just feel my body in a rhythm. And it was just a natural feeling. So I just, even though my adventures are more modest now, they're still there and a challenge. And so, whatever they are, I enjoy them.
For me, running around Starnberger See in one night, like 50 kilometers would not be a modest challenge. So it's all relative.
Yeah, exactly.
It is indeed.
Exactly. And I think it is relative. And, whether you solo Everest or whether you just hike a 200 meter hill, around where you live, it's relative. And I think that, and it doesn't really matter because I think they're all the same experiences. Some sound much more spectacular than others, but I think for the individual, it's pretty inspirational. I mean, it could be life changing. And so I'm just, I'm kind of aware of relativity. And so I want to help. Yeah, maybe people in wheelchairs do something that they've always wanted to do, or people that are less fortunate than I am. But so those are some of my thoughts.
Yeah, no, and I see that in action with you working with our students, John. That there's always encouraging and supporting our students to really. Yeah, to reflect on what they're doing and see where they can develop themselves further in terms of adventure, and to encourage them to take those first steps, and also experience the aspect, the nature side of the adventures and the outdoors too. So I think from talking with you, it's not just the physical activity; it's that time out in nature and appreciating nature, and that's something that always comes across.
Oh, thanks. Yes, I try to. It's nature's enriched my life so much that I just want to share that with other people and to see the sunrise and to go over the next hill and down the next valley and just to see the the remarkable flora in the area. It's just, it's a wonderful feeling.
And in your experience, do you think from seeing and working with other people that do outdoor activities that they take the skills from adventure into their professional lives and their lifestyles as well? Do you think that the experiences of doing these types of activities transfer?
Well, I think a lot of companies think it does, because they, mm-hmm. you know, they sign up their managers for outward bound courses and Knowles, that's National Outdoor Leadership School, adventures. And I think it must. I think that by putting people in touch with themselves in an outdoor setting tells the people a lot about themselves. And I think that it would go into the leadership styles that the company CEO is trying to get across, maybe, and working as a team, or bonding, or just feeling more self-confident. So I think, I just really think we could, benefit by nature and experiential learning in an outdoor setting. Mm-hmm.
Because we talk a lot about communication, me being a communications adventurer. So also going back to your story in Alaska with the dogs, and you felt that they were communicating with you. What kind of communication skills do you think you've acquired through those adventures? Like either with you mentioned also with yourself, because I do think communicating with ourselves, like knowing ourselves, is a big skill, and a bit more in respect to other people.
Yes, communication. It's I struggle with that issue a bit because of societal constraints. You know, it used to be when I was a teacher, you could go up and touch a student on their shoulders and say, this is hard, but I know you could add this problem together. And I felt that by touching is an important part of communication. And now in the schools, you can't do that very easily. But I still believe that communicating just by touching, and they've done experiments with baby monkeys and their mothers and other people, that somehow there's a connection in feeling and in touching. But I think listening is an important part of communication, and sensing. Using some kind of sense to just to try to empathize with the person you're trying to communicate with, what they want to get across. And so I think it's more than just conversing. It's more than just talking. And I try to do it, tactfully. I mean, by touching or helping, but I also try to listen and kind of sense a way to communicate, because everybody communicates differently. And so, it's a hard area, this communication, but I try to do my best just to be empathetic and warm and understanding and communicate with that person on their plane, whatever that is. I mean, that's pretty obtuse, I guess, analysis of communicating, but.
Yeah, well, very interesting. And I totally agree. Like in theatre, you don't just communicate through the words. As soon as you bring yourself, well, not just in theatre, but in real life, as soon as we bring mm-hmm. ourselves, like even just standing there, we're already communicating something. So, and I guess, like going into nature and listening, opening up and on a with your senses more consciously, maybe, or depending more on that because you don't have the verbal words to exchange, like can probably help you become more in tune with those other ways of mm-hmm. communicating rather than just through words.
Yeah, no, that's a really good observation, I think, because when I go into nature and I take kids into nature, and Carrie understands this very well too, that the kids in their world, the students in their world are so caught up in their own world, they're talking. They're talking all constantly and loudly in nature. After a while, nature prevails, I think. And during their pauses of their constant conversations, they might hear a bird. And then they might pause a little bit longer, a little later, and they might hear two birds. And then they might pause a little longer later, and they might hear like the wind. And they might pause a little longer, and they would hear something else. And eventually, I think they communicate with nature somehow. And they think, well, I'm just a minor part of this whole ecosystem. And so this is wonderful that the grass is growing, and maybe I could hear it if I listen. But they talk a little, maybe quieter, or it takes a while. It takes days, maybe, or it might take weeks. But I think they learn to communicate just by being out there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Carrie actually has commented very similarly on the podcast on when you mm-hmm. take students out, how they talk so much at first, and then it takes some time.
Yeah.
Until they start listening. And it shows the value of mm. those experiences. And I'm sure it's not just children, young people who are like that.
No, it's not just children.
Yeah.
Either. It's, you know, it's similar with adult groups. I mean, I think we're similar. We've always got something going on. There's a constant kind of noise around us all the time and kind of need to have chatter. And eventually it does at some point stop, and you stop and listen. I mean, it's the same if you're going out after having a busy day just by yourself. You've got your own chatter probably going on for a bit, and then it eases and you start listening. And then once, I think with it's almost like layers. Every time, once you've gone out, you hear a bit, and then you get used to that layer. And then the next time you go out, you hear the second layer of what's outside, and eventually a whole different world of sound opens up to you, and that comes through.
Yes, I think the outdoors can offer us so much. It's just, yes, a high priority of mine.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think that leads us to our final question.
Oh,
Carrie, would you agree?
So this is, I know Sarah said that she had a tough one for you before, but this is maybe an equally tough one. If you could only have one more adventure in your life, John, what would it be? Other than a D&B adventure with us.
Duke of Edinburgh is, that's a good adventure. That's really difficult. One more adventure. I'm thinking about that constantly. You know, next year I'd like to write a book on the existentialism of bike touring. And I'm just going to ride, I think, my bike from Munich up to Oslo and then across to Stockholm maybe, and then back down to Anchorage. But just to get in the feeling of that. But I don't know, a great adventure. A lot of my great adventures have been done, like walking to the North Pole or South Pole or climbing Everest alone. What would I want to do? I don't although I think of adventures, although I think they it happens to me where at, sometimes I don't even expect it, I'll get some kind of message somehow. And they'll say, yes, that's the adventure I want to do. Gosh, oh, Sarah, I wanted to run a marathon across the Sahara, ultra marathons. But I don't think I'm going to do that anymore because people are doing that a lot.
Is that a criteria that too many people are doing?
Yeah, that's part of the criteria. Because I want to experience it. Well, it's not as selfish. Well, it probably is selfish, but I just want to do it because I love doing it. And yeah, a lot of people kind of do it because it's maybe a popular thing to do. So maybe we'll have to have another podcast and
on all the potential.
When I get some inspiration for some adventure. So, yes, sorry, I don't have a good answer for that. So,
I think what you were just saying already shows what was great, like that maybe it'll just come to you and then you'll take it. You don't always know. You can't always plan an adventure in that way.
Right. And I think that's what the outdoors education does for people is it just, you know, you can't plan your life totally. And so if you sprain your ankle or you see a beautiful waterfall or you get rained on or it teaches you adaptability and just a way to overcome challenges or to enjoy the experience. And I just, I'm still looking for, just different adventures.
Well, we're curious to see what it'll be. And maybe there will be a part two of interview here.
I'm sure there will be. I'm sure there will be. There will be enough many more adventures to fill a pot.
Yes, oh,
and
yes.
Probably a podcast in itself, as in like a whole podcast series. Well, thank you so much, John. This has been really interesting and eye-opening and inspiring on so many levels. Like, I love the idea that. To just listen and see when an adventure comes and that you can't plan adventures, at least not to the whole extent. And I feel inspired to push myself a bit more into adventures in the outdoors.
Oh, thank you very much. Yes, I just, I didn't want to get too philosophical, but sometimes, yes, I just, nature and life, you know, makes me that way sometimes. And so... Yeah, that's the way I am right now. Thanks.
Oh, we like philosophical. That's that's one thing we aim for.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. That's the meaning. What's the meaning of life? And this is one of my meanings of life. So
absolutely, and it comes through. I think one of the things that always sticks with me is how you keep this infectious curiosity and joy of the small things in life and nature that we experience through working together. So and that's comes through your through your stories too. So
thanks very much.
Thank you for sharing your experiences with us today.
And I'd like to add, and you leave space for everybody to experience their own adventures. The amount of adventures you've experienced and the size of them, like you could look down on other people's little adventures, but you don't do that. You're still encouraging and you let people experience what they need to experience.
Oh, yeah. Thank you very much. Yes, I think joie de vie, joy of life, the French say. Mm-hmm. But I think everybody should experience their own joy of life, whether it's theater communication or Duke of Edinburgh or just creating some kind of outdoor game. It's just it's a good part of life.
Well, Yeah, thank you. And we'll wrap it up here.
Okay, thank you, ladies, for inviting me. And hopefully we'll see each other down the line. All right.
Definitely somewhere.
Goodbye.
Thank you, John.
Well, that was really exciting and interesting listening to John talk. And as he left, he told us that he's off to Lake Garda right now. His wife was waiting with suitcases packed, so we were lucky to get his time until now. And
absolutely.
Kerry, I have a question for you, mm-hmm. a serious one.
Yes, okay.
Are you going to cut down on your cake consumption after with John's wisdom?
Well, yes, I mean, I do spend a lot of time talking with John on expeditions about my tea and cake consumption. So, yeah, he could verify that maybe I could reduce one of the two. But I think everything in moderation.
True.
That is my message. Yeah. But did you take anything else with you, Sarah, from that chat other than reducing cake content?
Yeah, I feel I feel very inspired to go on to some more adventures and in the outdoors too. I mean, I've got plenty in the theatre world and I love going into the outdoors and just expanding that. And there was so much he spoke about. I really loved when he spoke about listening to the dogs or the dogs talking to him, saying that mm-hmm. Mandy, I think the dog was...
Brandy,
tired and just had it, and how the voice was so clear. That must have been such a strong moment. How about you?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's also always a lot to take in terms of learning from John's stories. What I found interesting was actually going back to how his interest in, I'd say, sports really started, and having a teacher that recognised where his talents also lay. And to also realise that we're all, you know, I think that's a real point to recognise that we're all different and we all have our talents and adventures in different areas as well.
I do wonder what would have happened if she had said, you are a great singer, you are amazing at singing. If what would have happened then? Because I know an opera singer, you know him too, I think, mm-hmm. and he was told he had a terrible voice and he couldn't sing. And actually he didn't believe the teacher and then went mm-hmm. ahead, and he's an opera singer. So I'm always a bit wary about, I mean, she didn't say he couldn't sing and she encouraged him to do things in the outdoors. Yet I am always a bit wary about people who discourage in some way or another from people to doing things.
No, I appreciate that. I think what I take with me from that though is the fact that we also do, yeah, that we all have our strengths also in different areas, and having that, and that John, you know, John through his adventures also recognizes, you know, that adventures are relative as well, and adventures can be in the outdoors, they can be through experiences in nature and through personal challenge, and that can come also through different environments. But having those adventures in the outdoors maybe gives you the confidence to take on the adventures in other areas as well.
Yes, and the power of encouragement.
Yes.
Well then, bye-bye, Kerry.
Bye-bye, Sarah. See you next time.
Thank you so much for listening to The Grow Zone, Real-Time Adventures. If you've enjoyed this episode and want to listen to more episodes or find out more about The Grow Zone, go to www.thegrowzone.de. If you would like to connect with us, you can find me, Sarah Hoopner, at www.improverin.com. And to connect with me, Kerry Temple, you can find me on www.fourelements.eu.